Like my parents were just here.
Any. So I had some questions about the presentation. And in addition to telling the class what was the most important thing that you learned from the article without summarizing, or what was the most important thing you disagreed with, you might want also to say, well, here's a question that I'd like the class to consider. Here's a question that I think we ought to discuss based on this reading. The other thing is that someone told me that apparently the Bateman, Russell et al. Case book is a new edition. It didn't appear on my desk until a couple of days ago, so apparently some of the cases that are on my course outline are not in that new edition, and there's some new cases there. So what I will do is I'll make amends. I will post a new outline on the web page, but I won't do that till I get back from Jamaica. So I have to be at the airport by 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. And then we have a party here afterwards. So I'll do that when I get back from Jamaica, but there are most of the cases that I've got in the course outline are in the new edition of the casebook. So start reading those. I'll make amends later. Okay, so I talked about the written constitution so far. The unwritten part of our constitution consists of constitutional conventions. And these are principles that are considered so important that the government ought not to violate them. So for example, the rule of law. The rule of law is mentioned in the preamble to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms now. But even though Dicey said it's one of the basic principles of the British Constitution, that's the only place it's mentioned in the Canadian Constitution. So the rule of law basically means that the law applies equally to everyone, unless there are reasonable exceptions built into the law itself. The law has to be applied impartially. So there can be no arbitrariness. And any public official who makes somebody suffer other than for violation of the law, that's considered an abuse of power. So the rule of law was recognized after the Glorious Revolution in England in 1688. And I find it quite interesting when I see the revolutions going on in countries around the world. The same thing happened in Britain for 400 years prior to 1688. So freedom is purchased always at a very dear price. Unfortunately, there seems to have to be a lot of blood shed to get to that stage. So we need to value it. Judicial independence I've already discussed. Even though it's in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms now with regard to criminal cases, it's not mentioned anywhere with regard to other kinds of cases. But according to the Supreme Court in Valenti, it's a principle that applies to all courts at all levels. Responsible government. Responsible government came out of the 50 years after the Glorious Revolution, when government was kind of chaotic in England. Scotland wasn't yet part of Great Britain. So what happened was that the king continued to control the public service. Parliament was supreme and could limit the powers of the king. But there was a lot of patronage that went on in the public service because the king was in charge. So eventually it was decided that rather than have ministers appointed by the king running the various government departments, the ministers ought to be people who are elected to sit in the House of Commons or occasionally appointed to sit in the House of Lords. So it's really, if Parliament is going to be supreme, then the ministers have to be in Parliament. So responsible government means that the cabinet, which is the heads of all the ministries, the cabinet is responsible to the legislature and maintains power only so long as the legislature allows them to maintain power. So in the... just trying to think of what it was. In the 1980s in Ontario, we had a minority conservative government led by Frank Miller. His government was defeated in a confidence motion by the Liberals and the NDP. Frank Miller wanted to call another election. He went to the Lieutenant Governor, and the Lieutenant Governor said, nope, if the Liberals and the NDP think they can form a coalition to run the government, that's the Convention of Responsible Government. So the Liberals and the NDP formed a coalition, and then there was another election in which the Liberals won. So we had several constitutional crises federally in the last few years. In one of them, Stephen Harper said it would be anti-democratic for the opposition to form a coalition government. That's an absolute mischaracterization of responsible government. And he knows better. So the cabinet is responsible to the legislature at all times. Ministerial accountability. Individual ministers are accountable to the legislature for the administration of their departments. Now, it used to be the case that when government departments consisted of 100 or 200 people, the minister was in charge of everything. And if there was a serious administrative error in the department, the minister would resign because the minister should have seen the danger coming and made sure that, that things didn't get out of hand. Now government departments are much, much bigger. Every time there's a big administrative screw-up in a department, the opposition asks for the minister to resign. It hardly ever happens unless the minister himself or herself is really responsible for the screw-up. So I think Bevolder should have resigned a long time ago. Thank goodness she finally has. Because she was personally responsible for some major errors. But it's up to us to make sure that the government abides by these conventions. Cabinet solidarity is very, very important. When I worked for a cabinet minister in Alberta during the time of the Lougheed government, of course, I used to hear from my minister what went on in the cabinet meetings. Of course, in the legislature, there's a lot of arguing between the government and the opposition members. It's nothing like what goes on in cabinet. There is shouting that goes on in cabinet. And the reason for that is cabinet solidarity. All cabinet ministers are expected to support the collective decision of the cabinet or resign. You cannot speak out against a cabinet decision. It's a very good principle because it does force this debate within the cabinet so that all the ministers are pretty much on side, or at least they realize, if I can't support this, I have to resign. So these were principles developed in the first part of the 1700s, but they continue to evolve after that. The Governor General and the Lieutenant Governors have to act according to the advice of the First Minister, unless that advice is unconstitutional. So when Frank Miller went to the Lieutenant Governor and said, I want you to call an election, that was unconstitutional advice. So it doesn't have to be followed. So it's really important that the Governor General and the Lieutenant Governors understand these conventions. They get together, I think, at least annually now to discuss with each other constitutional issues. They have educational seminars. Canada's current Governor General is very well schooled in this. It makes me feel a lot better. So that's one of the reforms I think we need to make to the monarchy in Canada, just to make sure that our representatives of the monarch understand what they're doing. Okay, so one part of our unwritten constitution is the constitutional conventions, and they are there to protect democratic accountability. That's their whole purpose. They evolve over time to make them better. The ratio in judicial decisions about the meaning of the Constitution. So that is part of our unwritten Constitution. Judge-made law. As I mentioned earlier, approach to judicial decision-making in Quebec is different from the rest of the country because of the civil law system in Quebec for private law. So this is just an outline of when various laws were codified in Quebec based on French tradition. And I mentioned already some of the differences between the civil law approach to judging and the common law approach. When I was doing my study of appeal court decision making in the 1990s, my colleagues and I asked all of the combination civilian and common law judges, that is all the judges in Quebec, and the judges on the Supreme Court of Canada, the other Section 101 courts, is there a difference between the way the common law judges and civil law judges decide cases? And a minority of the judges, I think it was around 20%, said yes, there's a very big difference, and they explained all this about the difference between stare decisis and the civil law precedent system. The rest, the majority said, you know, there's not very much difference anymore. We take the best of both systems to help us decide. So the two systems are coming closer together. And the same thing has been found in Europe, that the common law system in England, the civil law system in the rest of the continent, they seem to be coming closer together in terms of judicial approaches. They now realize something can be learned in the other system. Back in the time of Dicey, Dicey said nothing can be learned from the civil law system. It's terrible. And the civilian lawyers thought nothing can be learned from the English system. So I think I've covered all that. So in some of the cases that you read, you'll be reading about natural justice. There are two parts to natural justice, and they're often expressed in Latin. The first is nemo iudex in sua causa. And that basically means you can't be a judge in your own cause. So that refers to the fact that judges have to be impartial. They have to try to be as impartial as possible. The other is audi altera parte. And that means hear both sides. So in the adversary system, judges have to give a fair hearing to both sides in the case. And if one side feels that they haven't been heard adequately, that might be a grounds for appeal. So natural justice is a principle that judges apply to all decisions where the rights and responsibilities of citizens are involved. So you'll see natural justice discussed not only in Charter of Rights cases, where it is under Section 7 quite clearly. Section 7 says that we have a right to fundamental justice, which is another variation of natural justice, unless you deprive the wrong, etc. So natural justice is really important, the history of it, to understand fundamental justice, but it crops up in other issues where rights and responsibilities are affected outside of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And you as public servants are expected to use the principles of natural justice in any of your decisions that affect rights and responsibilities. So you have to be as impartial as possible. You have to hear both sides. This gets into some administrative law issues in terms of how the courts classify administrative agencies. I'm going to leave that for your 6120 course and not get into it today. With regard to administrative law, as I mentioned, because of Section 96, there can always be judicial review. And it could be on the grounds of jurisdiction. You could argue that an administrative tribunal is acting outside of jurisdiction. It could be because of abuse of power, that is, somebody is making somebody else to suffer and not according to law. It could be because of natural justice, if that's a relevant argument. It could be because of the doctrine of fairness. doctrine of fairness is that natural justice should apply in all administrative agencies where relevant. Now, labor relations tribunals were invented, first of all, by the federal government in the early 1900s, and then by provincial governments to try to create labor peace. And the members of labor relations tribunals have always been people that are expert in labor law, either for corporations or for labor unions. So they know what they're doing. Generally speaking, in the early part of this century, judges and the critical legal theorists who write about this, they come from the upper echelons. Very few of them have been members of labor unions. They don't understand labor issues. But in the early part of the century, they often overruled labor tribunals. And they made terrible decisions. So both federal and provincial governments started to insert privative clauses into labor legislation, saying that the decision of the labor tribunal is final, there shall be no appeal. And of course, those privative clauses were often overruled by superior court judges who said, no, you're interfering with our jurisdiction, we have the right to hear these cases. So even with a privative clause, if there's a constitutional issue or you argue that a decision of the tribunal is patently unreasonable, then the superior court will hear it. They might not overturn it, but at least they'll hear it. So we have rules of statutory interpretation to help judges decide consistently. And this is developed. This was developed by the common law over centuries. The judges consider what is the intent of the legislature in framing the legislation. Sometimes, at the beginning of a piece of legislation, the legislation will say, whereas such and such and such is a problem. The problem is known in judicial jargon as the mischief. So if you see judges talking about the mischief, they think, well, what is the problem that the legislation is trying to address? So what is the intent of the legislature? But they can only get that from how the legislation is written, the context of how the legislation is written. You'll see the reasonable person test mentioned in a number of cases. The judge will say, well, how would a reasonable person, informed of the appropriate issues, decide this case? I will put myself in the shoes of a reasonable person and who has enough information to decide, and this is how I will decide. The reasonable person test is very, very vague, but it's very often used because there's nothing else that they can refer to. Then there's the plain meaning rule. If there's difficulty interpreting a statute, let's give it the most straightforward meaning we possibly can. The golden rule. Legislatures did not intend to make anything absurd or inconsistent. They might have made mistakes in the wording. Let's correct those mistakes for them so it's not absurd or inconsistent. As I mentioned, what was the mischief? And then what is the remedy for the mischief in the legislation? If there's a general word that could be somewhat vague, maybe the specific words nearby will help to define it. And you'll see that being used in some of the decisions of the Judicial Committee and the Privy Council for the readings in October. Sometimes, if certain things are expressly included, that implies the exclusions of items not mentioned. And eventually, that's what the JCPC did to Section 91 of our Constitution. They said, well, here's a list of federal government powers. There are certain things that were not mentioned, so they were probably meant to be excluded. Both federal and provincial governments have interpretation statutes. These are pieces of legislation that are designed to help the judges interpret all the legislation in that jurisdiction. Um, And sometimes the legislation includes definitions. The judges will look at the context of a particular part of a statute in relation to the rest of it. They'll look at other similar statutes. Since 1976, they have looked at legislative history. Now, before 1976, the judges would never look at the debates in the provincial legislature or parliament to help them understand the purpose of the legislation. This was because it was considered hearsay evidence. It wasn't directly presented in court. But in 1976, in the anti-inflation case, there was evidence admitted from economists who were arguing about how serious inflation was in 1976. So the first time the Supreme Court of Canada accepted social science evidence, but they gave it, they said, well, it could help us, but we're not going to say that this evidence is conclusive. They also admitted at that time evidence about the debates in Parliament, but they gave it minimal weight. The reason for that is people get up in Parliament and they speak. Unless there's a vote on what they said, we don't know how many people in Parliament agree with them. So it can help us a bit, but it can't help us decide. The only thing that can help us decide Parliament's will is the final vote in Parliament. So we'll see that in some of the Charter of Rights cases where Jean Chrétien, for example, in Parliament said the Charter of Rights and Freedoms is not meant to affect abortion, the abortion legislation in Canada. And the Supreme Court said, well, we'll accept that evidence, but Chrétien was really just speaking for himself. So various kinds of books, like legal dictionaries are sometimes used in decisions. The great advantage we have in Canada is we have a French and an English text. For those of you that speak more than one language, you realize different languages have different nuances. And so if you can read something in two different languages, you get a better idea of what was intended by the legislation. International conventions, and I told you earlier how they have to be recognized as being part of domestic law. But they are used as aids to interpretation. So for example, in the Baker case of the early 2000s, it was a case where Mrs. Baker was about to be deported to the Caribbean because she was an illegal immigrant. But a number of her children were born in Canada. And the people in immigration didn't take into account at all the effect that this was going to have on her children, not having a mother. So the Supreme Court said, well, Canada has signed the International Convention on the Rights of Children. So we need to interpret what we do here, taking that into account. That convention is not definitive. It's not part of Canadian law. But it does signal that Canada intended to have its laws interpreted in conformity with that convention. So more and more, the Supreme Court is willing to use international conventions as an aid to interpretation, even though they're not part of our law. Every piece of legislation has a preamble that helps the judges interpret it. There are marginal notes in the legislation that really tell you what this very long paragraph is saying. It summarizes it. Those marginal notes, the judges don't use. Now, sometimes the headings for particular pieces of legislation are used to interpret, but there's an Ontario statute that says the headings cannot be used for judicial interpretation in Ontario. How many want to be judges? Now, because in criminal cases, the state has a lot of power, the accused person doesn't have as much. If there's any vagary in the law, it's interpreted in favor of the accused person. I've used that a couple of times, well, the taxation law in favor of the taxpayer. I disagreed with the way I've been assessed by the Canada Revenue Agency. They've actually gone to speak to someone. And I said, you know, there's two ways of interpreting this. And they said, yeah, we're interpreting according to what we think is right. I said, no, that's wrong. You have to interpret it according to what I think is right. And in both cases, I persuaded them. So it's something useful to know. There's a presumption against the alteration of common law. There's a presumption of mens rea. That is, you can't pass a law that would find someone guilty if they didn't realize what they were doing. Let's say if they were sleepwalking or they were mentally ill. The exception to that is sometimes legislatures pass absolute liability laws. And they say, don't take into account mens rea, the guilty mind. Only take into account what they actually did. Whether or not they realized they were doing it, it doesn't matter. One of the very famous charter cases we'll be looking at in November deals with how the Supreme Court of Canada dealt with absolute liability legislation in British Columbia. So once again, there's a presumption against preventing courts from hearing certain kinds of cases unless it's absolutely clear. There used to be a presumption for Crown immunity, that you could not sue the Crown. But in all the provinces and federally now, they've made it pretty easy to sue the Crown just like you can sue a person. The judges consider that every word in the statute is deliberate. Specific words are given precedence over general words. That's one of the things that got us into trouble with the division of powers. In the provincial list of powers, the words are very specific. In the federal list, the words are very general. So the JCPC interpreted the Canadian Constitution like an ordinary statute. So more recent legislation is given precedence over older legislation if there's a conflict. There's a presumption that drafting errors were not intended. So spelling mistakes, typos, that sort of thing. The courts will just correct them because they weren't intended. Oh my goodness, we've gone over 3 o'clock. But I've gotten you through the really boring part now. So let me just check with Professor Sonikin and see if she's ready for us. I'm pretty sure she is. Upstairs.